So the first thing I can say about this is I'm not going to fool you. This is not going to be an easy talk. And there's a reason for that. If you can you raise your hand if you have been in a talk in cosmology before with the word biology in the title? No. Okay, there is a good, very good reason for that. And that reason is that no one is idiot enough to even start to tackle this lunacy. So that's the first thing I want to say. The second thing is this has been very, very challenging. It's a project that we started in October. I think I was trying to sum up the hours of discussion that we have each week, just discussion on this. And it's about at least 3 hours per week, a full discussion, and still, you know, it's very, very unprepared material. The other thing I want to say is that this is a talk about initial conditions. So I didn't cross over to biology and join the dark side, or I'm going to talk a lot about entropy and a lot of biological systems, but really my only interest, I don't care about entropy, I don't care about biology, I want to understand the problem of initial conditions. So that's the motivation for this talk. I don't think there was anything else I wanted to say. I guess this, for those of you who were here in the Time in Cosmology meeting that Lee and I held about 3-4 years ago now, this is based on a talk that Stu gave on is a theoretical biologist. And it took me about 3 years to cook up what it was that he was saying. And in July last year, I just want to woke up and say, oh my God, that's what he was saying. And after that, you know, you can't go, it becomes very obvious and you don't understand why you didn't see it before. So let's start. Cosmology, I put the first sentence there to tie my work on irreversibility with Lee and initial conditions. So why am I as a cosmologist working on irreversibility? For this crowd, I don't need to explain the problem of initial conditions as measure zero, but I do need to state these assumptions, which are the standard method for how we quantify the problem of initial conditions today. So compute the entropy, get via the Boltzmann's formula, get the number of microphysical degrees of Friedman, call it configuration space, Hilbert space, whatever you get it from the Boltzmann formula. Assume that the configuration space and the laws remain constant during the universe's evolution. This is going to be key during the whole talk, is that our computation needs to have this ingredient that no extra states are added onto the configuration space when the universe is in evolution. So you start at the Big Bang with entire possible number of states. And this is just a quick run through the standard method. So 30 years ago, this is how you would compute entropy today. So it's just a hot plasma. And this is kind of, I remember reading papers on inflation that tried to solve that, a problem of that sort with that number. But if this was really the whole amount of degrees of freedom in the universe, we would just see these. There would be no structure, dark matter structure. And so we need to include, in order to explain our universe, we need to include one more interaction. We need to take into account that gravity plays a very key role in the entropy today. And particularly, as you know, gravity has a negative specific heat. So it acts the opposite of thermal motions and thermal interactions. And particularly, a hot homogeneous plasma is the worst state from the point of view of gravity that you can start with, because that's the lowest entropy state for gravity. So we only know one way, or we know the entropy of gravity for one state, for one system, not more. And it's just the black hole entropy. And from that, we're going to derive a lot of things. So this is the entropy and gravity in our universe. We start by assuming that there's a black hole with 10 to the 10 solar masses, more or less like ours. The black hole is 10 to the 6 solar masses, galaxy is 10 to the 10. Then you know the number of baryons, you multiply this number, which is obtained from the Bekenstein-Hawking formula, by the number of baryons, and you obtain this result. And then, so 10 to the 1 to the 100. And then you say, if all galaxies in some faraway future collapse into a massive, supermassive black hole, then the formula gives you this number for the entropy, which then, for the entropy. So today the universe is as this likelihood given by the entropy today. And, And if it was, if there was a black hole only as the final state, we would have 120 here instead of 100. And the next slide is just if a computation which doesn't change by a lot, if the black hole at the center of the galaxy, a typical black hole would be like an M87 rather than our own galaxy. So you just get a small difference here in the value of the entropy today, and this is in natural units, of course. So now we have thermal motions, and we have gravity, and are we done counting the contributions to the entropy of the universe, current entropy? So we are not done counting. This is not a result that I really like, but it's currently accepted. and I think, I mean, we have to live with it. So the universe is not under the domination of gravity, and this is like the right side of gravity, because lambda is gravity as well. But if the universe is dominated by the vacuum, then you can compute an approximate value for the entropy given by the cosmic horizon and the number of Planck areas in our cosmic horizon. And that gives a fantastically large number. So again, this 10 to the 120. I asked Ted Jacobson last time he was here, how come the 10 to the 120 you get from the cosmic horizon and 10 to the 120 you get from a black hole, if there was a supermassive merged black hole? And he said, no, that must be a coincidence. Really? Yeah, I think that's a coincidence. There must be a factor of 2 or 3 there. So I don't know. I mean, if anybody knows, please stand up and explain.
Sorry. Can you repeat that? But do you get some merged black holes?
If the entropy, the ultimate state of the universe under gravity, if that were to be a supermassive black hole where all the galaxies have merged, right, that entropy of that black hole would be 10 to the 120.
Right. Okay.
And then, you know, this is... the Bekenstein bound, the derivation is like Susskind and Raphael Busso and things like that. But I think it's the same thing. But anyway, so that's a big number. And I guess.
Can I ask a question?
Yes?
How do you compute the likelihood of a Big Bang?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sorry. I didn't say that. So, yeah, that's a good question. Actually, the answer is I don't know. But so you have the, where's my equation? Here, you have Boltzmann's formula. This is going to be the number of degrees of freedom. This is the volume of microphysical states that give rise to that entropy. And then you invert these and say the increase of entropy during the universe's evolution at least needs to be account for this, the entropy we see today. So the likelihood is then one corresponds to only one state in the set of all possible states represented in the volume there. Yeah, but that's a good question because we don't really understand this. This is an assumption I've seen again and again in the literature, and in discussions, we have not been very happy with the answer first. So, okay, that's a big number. We know you're in trouble if you need an exponential to represent your exponent. So that's a big number. Are we now done counting? We have the thermal motions, the gravity, and the vacuum. Are we done counting entropy? And can we go on to try and solve these initial conditions? And that's to do with really what is our ambition for cosmology? What is cosmology? What do you want to explain with it? So, the answer for the entropy depends on what parts of the universe you want to include the explanation for in the initial conditions. So what seeds do you want to put there and account for? Today, this is cosmology. We model galaxies as point particles in a homogeneous fluid, blah, blah. We know all this very well. And right now what we're doing, or part of what we're doing, is extracting information from increasingly smaller scales. And I realized that this sentence was the reason why I was doing this project. So I started my career when I was 10 as a ballet dancer. And I was in the Conservatory for Arts and stayed there 10, 12 hours a day, every day. And they gave us very little math and very little literature, very little languages. And I picked up a book when I was about 16. I was really bored because all we did was dance all day and there was not really anything to study. And I picked up a book that my dad had lying around. And I was like, oh my God, if I can't dance anymore, I want to be an astrophysicist. And no one knew what I was talking about. And she's insane. And but one of the things that I remember more.
How about your dad? Because this was your dad's book.
Did
he support that notion?
Yeah, I guess my dad is kind of, he's a mad scientist. I think he might not even be aware that I'm a physicist. I mean, in a very dear and loving way. This will be another talk. So, this is the opening sentence of Cosmos. And this is a personal, a taste kind of decision or view. But, you know, my ambition for cosmology is that not right now, not in 100 years, but eventually in 1,000 years, next millennium, we are going to be able to explain literally all the phenomena that we see around us. So that's the ambition. So what is the number that we have not included? Our budget for the entropy of the universe looks like this. So dead, and not like this. What is the configuration space of the biosphere, or what is the number of degrees of freedom in the biosphere, or what is the Hilbert space of the biosphere, whatever you want to call it. I wrote that, what is the entropy of life? That's just a teaser. We're not going to compute entropy of life. But it's to give an impression of what it is that we're trying to measure. So is the entropy of life sizable and to be accounted for? Is it negligible compared to the entropy of lambda? We all would say completely negligible. I mean, there's far fewer particles in the biosphere than there is in the whole universe. So it's just the question is ridiculous. But this is the project we're trying to do. We're going to give biological systems. We're going to try and treat them with physical principles. And the point is to see if we can quantify the diversity in the biosphere. And how many states are there possible in the biosphere? So inclusion of biology, that's what we mean by that. There are less particles. If we do simple permutation of particles on the volume, space-time volume of the biosphere, we're going to get a much smaller number than this. However, our configuration space methodology does not account for the formation of complex structures. And in particular, it does not account for new effective interactions that might arise and emerge when we are going into a next effective regime. So there's new degrees of freedom. Again, this is states. They are not captured in our method. I said this. This is the method that we use most. You could call it, I think it's the Newtonian paradigm, but it can be, you could call it Hilbert, or I didn't put here, Will-o'-the-Wheat, Schrodinger, whatever you, this is kind of the methodology we use. And classically, it's six-dimensional. We have the laws need to be deterministic. Again, this doesn't need to hold for Hilbert space. You have the boundary conditions. And again, this important assumption there, that no new states are to be added to the configuration space while you're doing the accounting. If you add new states, the universe has, say, it's gone into a new effective field theory regime, and you add new states, what you're doing is you're splitting the problem of initial conditions. You then have a part of the initial conditions to explain at the Big Bang, and you have to explain how that new novel degree of freedom state has arisen. So this is the argument that Stu makes. Let me see if I already say here. So there's limitations of our methodology in physics to explain complex structures. I'm going to talk about biology, but condensed matter, this is a very famous or mundane result. They claim often and very precisely that emergent phenomena in many body physics though are not explainable or derivable from simpler constituents. So I think it was Leggett that said something like, nothing has ever come to condensed matter from the reductionist principle, or from taking the microphysical degrees of freedom in my fluid and deriving the properties of superconductivity or superfluids, whatever. So this is not restricted to biology, but it's biology that we're talking about.
I must say this doesn't sound right in the sense that if you count up the entropy that you can, of all possible states that you can describe in terms of the microphysical particles, and then you recount the entropy at some more macroscopic level, it's some more coarse grained level, it's got to be lower. I mean, when they say more is different and you can't, you know, a phenomenon emerge that you can't derive from the microphysics, you know, there's two separate statements. One is that you can't derive it, it can't be explained even in principle in terms of the microphysics, and the other is that it can't be described in practice.
Yeah.
My understanding is that, you know, Phil Anderson and so on are saying that latter thing.
No, first, the first. You're saying the first. I'm quite sure.
I think the first thing was some very radical thing, which I don't think
this here is. This one also has. I can give you the references. They say it clearly.
I've read that article. More is different.
Okay, let me go here. No, actually, this is going to be fine. Hold on. Physicists don't find these easy.
All right.
And I agree with you. I mean, I need to agree with you in secret because Stu, if he heard me talking about this, that I don't believe that it's not derivable, it's a big shock. I think we need to have new methodology to derive it. So I think that we are able to derive emergent properties, or it's a belief I have no reason to say. But yeah, I'm stubborn as well. At the end of the day, like, I'm a closet reductionist kind of person. So okay, is that more or less, I mean, we can take it as existing. In the literature, there's this statement. So in particularly, the claim is that the phenomena they observe are as fundamental in particle as phenomena that we have in cosmology or particle physics.
That's good. Is there any examples in solid state physics that if you start from, say, quantum electrodynamics, there is no way to derive something or this is just some conjecture which is based on some thought rather than...
Which is this conjecture? The condensed matter?
Yeah, I take condensed matter. My belief would be that I take quantum electrodynamics, add their protons, neutrons, whatever, take this as a theory, and then I would think that I should be able to derive all solid state physics.
Yeah, so I'm going to come to that. I mean, there's might be many phenomena that are not derivable in physics, and I think there for sure are. Condensed matter is one of them, or if we agree with that. But the point here is more to give one example of something you cannot derive, of rules for interaction which emerge and cannot be derivable. So how do you go about computing how many states are possible in the biosphere? You can go back 3.5 billion years ago, write down, say you take organic molecules at the onset of life, you write down one equation of motion for each organic molecule, and you can choose Newton, Schrodinger, or Will-o'-the-Wheat, whatever your flavor is in for evolving life, and you write down all the possible states given those equations of motion. So the first thing to say about these is that that configuration space is never going to be explored. The universe or also in the biosphere is highly non-ergodic. And for example, one example of this is there are 20 amino acids. You need about 200 amino acids to make a protein. So the number of proteins is 20 to the 200, and we will never have 20 to the 200 actual proteins in the biosphere. So if you were to explore configuration space at a super microsecond fast rate, it would take a lot longer than the Hubble time. So this is the first consideration I find really interesting. What is the use of a theory or of a model if it takes us more than the Hubble time to achieve ergodicity? So the claim is then that there arise more complex structures continuously. They could not have been derived a priori. The biosphere explodes in diversity at some point in the past, and we cannot write down laws in our usual differential form. And so this is what I've said already. We cannot integrate equations of motion from constituent complex molecules, organic molecules, and from that predict what the cell that is made up of all those complex molecules is going to do. How is the evolution and behavior of the cell? And the same for an organism or a person. So now I'm coming to your point. We have a choice for deriving a Hilbert space or a configuration space for cosmology. If we take an effective field theory and we are at high temperature, it's just free states. There are no bound states. You are in some very high energy description. And we can just count in that part, in that state, we can just count free particle states. And then that's the entropy. We don't need to worry about bound states. There are no bound states. This is effective field theory one. Temperature falls down, say, to BBN, and we need a new theory to describe electromagnetism, nuclear bound states, or, bound nuclei. This is then a new theory, effective field theory two, which has more states than effective field theory one. And these are the bound states that are added on. So the theme here is that you have a new theory, a new regime emerging, which translates to a new interaction. And you, with that interaction, you add more possible states, which are bound states.
That's not more states, that's just more species of particles, or quasi-particles, but there are less states because you have lower temperatures, you have a smaller Hilbert space.
Oh, but you're not going to remove the previous ones.
You do. Low temperatures, you don't explore the...
Then that's fine. If you want to remove the previous ones, you can have less states or more states. I don't mind. This is actually, I'm going to say what is important.
Just the point is that lower temperatures, you have fewer momentum states that you could occupy.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you have fewer states.
Yeah.
You may have more of a species, but you have a smaller phase of space.
Yeah. So, but that's still for physics, and we are going to biology.
I can compute that without any effective field theory, right? I can take QCD, and QCD provides me a complete framework in which I can compute entropy at high temperatures and at low temperatures.
Mm-hmm.
There is no problem. I mean,
there's no problem.
Density
yeah.
goes down, as it was mentioned here, because the temperature gets smaller than the problem.
Okay, this is why there is no problem. There is a method. We have a standard model. So there's no new states arising at any point. There's a method from which you derive each new regime at lower and lower temperatures. There is perfectly consistent. Again, remember that at the Big Bang, you need to include the standard model states in order to have a fiducial accounting for the entropy, but there's nothing to it. I mean, actually, Carlo Rovelli, I don't know, well, you all know him, he disagrees with this. And I've been trying to discuss, I think, say, well, we all have a standard model of particle physics and cosmology. Those are, it's not a new regime, it's just, or it's a new effective regime which we can explain. So there's a method to evolve states. What is the analog in biology? Say that you start with, I thought I deleted that. I'm sorry for that. So say that you start with complex organic molecules. They have their own rules of interaction. It's, for some reason, at some point, they form amino acids, which again have their own rules of interaction, which are not the same from the molecules and are not to be derivable, or we don't know how to derive them. Then you go on to proteins, again, complete different level of complexity. Proteins are one of the most complex objects in the universe, in the information they contain. You get the first hint of a cell, which are in these organelles. Then you have cells. By the time you arrive to cells, you've completely forgot that you were made up of molecules. So all any resemblance in the laws that govern the molecules is completely lost. And this is the key here, which is different from physics. All these effective field theory regimes are derivable and understood, and we don't know how to derive the emergence of these new bound states.
My chemistry is not very good, but don't they calculate the entropy changes in chemical reactions?
Yeah.
So wouldn't these, forming or things like that?
Yeah. So what I mean by this is the equations of motion, the interaction does not transport from high energy, say, from the complex organic molecules to the amino acids. What I mean is that you cannot learn anything about the behavior of an amino acid from knowing the equations of motion for the organic molecules. And that's the claim. I mean, there is a lot of work on the entropy of life, but it's a little, it's not exactly what this is. But you understand the argument for the equations of motion, that they're not the same?
Yes, my point is, like, if you just treat them as chemical reaction, could I calculate the entropy increase at every step?
Or I think you would,
thing that you're saying?
You would, it's a simplistic version. So it doesn't capture, you wouldn't get large numbers from that. And really what we're looking for is to get the number as lambda. So that's obviously the project. So there is no standard model for biology currently. Their claim is that there will never be. And again, this key result, if we have a system in which new bound states are continuously emerging, you are never done counting the number of possible states, because you always have new complex structures or whatever you want to call it emerging.
Sorry, in what sense is that a result? It seems that it's just an unjustified.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah, no, it's not a result. I hope I tried to justify it. It's not.
I mean, in both cases, left and right, you have new bound states that are emerging, but a bound state can never be.
Because we don't have a standard model for biology.
Well, we have quantum mechanics and chemistry. So if the question is, can you have big enough computers to model this? I mean,
I see where you're going. If I have time, I will address that. I can tell you that that's not possible, or you need a computer larger than the Hubble, volume, or you need lots of Hubble times.
But that would be the same on the left-hand side as well. I mean,
because this is very simple reductionist physics. We all understand it, and we don't need a super large computer to compute.
You see, I mean, if you want to understand the mass of proton or many other things that are like non-perturbative QCD, then you need a large computer. And some of them we just don't understand.
Yeah, and maybe in that regime you're entering many body physics,
yeah.
Which is the claim that this is not valid for. So I guess I talk about what we in cosmology do in terms of what we call physics. If it's anything above atomic physics, I don't know. But this is what we work with. So biologists seem okay with this impossibility. We don't find it very easy. And this is very interesting book that John Brockman gave me last in the fall. And it's an assembly of questions by prominent figures on the EDGE group. And they ask, each person goes and asks, what is the last question? What is the most interesting question that I can think of right now? So we have here a few physicists. This is John Mather, one of our Nobel Prizes in cosmology. What is the master principle governing the growth and evolution of complex system? So it's this question that we're asking. This is a computer scientist, and the question is, what is the principle that causes complex adaptive systems to spontaneously emerge from the interaction of simpler elements, chemical cells, neurons, individual humans? And Seth Lloyd, who we know well, asks, how did our complex universe arise from physical laws? So we spent a lot of time trying to discuss what is the underlying principle that is true for all regimes in biology. And the only thing that we could come up with that always holds is as trivial as this, getting to exist. There's nothing at this point more complex or more informative that I can give you about what governs emergence of complex structures in biology. So you kind of could say this is the standard model, or this is the state at which the standard model of biology, if it were to exist, is. So one way that we can then go on and count the biosphere is by counting possible functions that can arise at each state. So for example, imagine that a bacteria will jump on the back of another bacteria and find there a competitive advantage. This becomes now a more fit organism, and they go on and just evolve and are successful. Other thing, a fish has developed a swim bladder, a bacteria swims by and finds, I'm going to jump in this swimming bladder, and that's quite an hospitable place to live. This is another example. And the point is to say that you can never, if you have a given state of constituents or whatever it is, your ontology, you can never state all the possibilities of the next state, because you can always think of one more interaction or one more use. And it's too like this sentence, what is the number of uses for a screwdriver? And then he goes on to the audience and everybody says, hey, I can hit you top of the head with it. Or I can, you know, I don't know, I can hold my Monet painting worth 3 million euros away from the rain. But you are never done counting. And also, there is not a particular function that you can point and say, that is not a function for a screwdriver. And by these, I mean, Stu asked me, okay, then what is, I have a screwdriver in outer space. What is the use for that screwdriver? And I said, well, I have a wormhole. I travel to the planet and I use it. So it's difficult to prove that this number of possible uses or possible interactions that arise is bounded. And what this talk is about is to prove that it is divergent. And so how are we going to treat that? So if it is unbounded, then we have experience in regulating infinities in physics. We only need to make an approximation to bring that unbounded number of possibilities of the configuration space. We just need to bring it down to lambda. And then we have already quite a strong statement, which is there is a lot more, I'm going to call it information, but it's not information. There's a lot more information in the biosphere than there is in the whole universe. So not information, but number of states in Hilbert space again. And this is captured in Stu's adjacent possible theory. So you don't know what is the next state that's going to be possible in the biosphere, but you know that you can express some of the things that are going to happen next. So this is the project. I'm just going to talk about here of the theory of the adjacent possible. This is also a very interesting concept of mutual information. Anybody have heard of mutual information? You heard about it, okay. So it's a physics or contextual dependent criterion for computing correlations. And if we knew the exact correlations between all particles in the biosphere, we could use the mutual information argument. But because we don't know, we don't know what particles are correlated. And indeed, all particles in the biosphere that share a causal past are correlated. And I can say why. So it's the kind of argument that if you say, okay, if all bees disappear from the planet on the other side of the globe, I don't have many years to live, kind of thing. So the biosphere is so densely correlated with itself and in such a critical point of equilibrium that the amount of mutual information is very large. But I'm just going to talk about this adjacent possible equation and why this is really what I find is very key for understanding why are these numbers so large. So biological systems, what's happening when you are emerging upwards? You take a subset of existing items and you combine them and you get a more complex item. But once you have combined that item and it's now a more complex one, that is available for going back and combining again with either a simpler one or a more complex one. So that's where the word combinatorial innovation comes, and the large numbers are coming exactly that you get to combine objects in a way that we don't usually in reductionist physics. The other point is that the rules of living systems are not commutative nor associative. So if you reach the states by a series of moves on n, they differ from those that change by a commutative or a associative operation. And so this is the kind of number that you get to assemble units. And what I was saying about is this important message that by the point, by the time you got to a cell, you started with complex organic molecules, but the cell has no memory anymore of the kind of interactions that the organic molecules obey. So for the point of view of the cell, it's completely forgotten that it used to be made up and obey organic molecules rules. So this is the concept of forgetfulness. And here is the example. I get object 3 comes from merger of object 1 and 2. Object 3 forgets where it's come. And it means that at the next iteration, it is free to combine again with a type object 1 or a type object 2 and create yet another item. So this is the super combinatorial or just combinatorial group of options, which is the reason why we get such large numbers with the adjacent possible. So if this possibility of combination and forgetfulness wasn't possible, then we would just get permutational rules like we're used to. So this is the equation. This is a simple version that I put here to start with. Equation represents the time evolution of the diversity of states in a given system. So you just say, I have a time t equals t, I have this number of states given by mt. And onto that, at each time step, I add combinations of all sub-items to the number of possible states. And sorry, let me see what I can have here. Oh, alpha. So this alpha measures the difficulty in finding sets of items when you go to larger numbers. So it's supposed to reflect the decrease ease in finding and testing new combinations. But for all versions I'm going to show you, what happens is that there is, in this mt plus 1, there is a long, slow period where there's no growth, it stays constant, and then all of a sudden it goes and blows up. I mean, not in finite time, but it's very fast. So this equation here, the first version is just deterministic, and there's no extinction. We have degrees of freedom going extinct all the time. So we need, at each time, we need to cut back a few numbers on the configuration space. So this is a more sophisticated version, which has this mu here, which is an extinction parameter. And then you can decide what is the number of combinations you maybe you just want to use combinations of 3 elements or 4 elements and not all the numbers available in MT. The point here that I'm going to make next is that this term is always going to dominate. Here is the evolution for a deterministic model and a stochastic model. This paper is actually a bit wrong. So we tried to derive these results. And what they did here is they saw the curve rising a lot. And they said, well, this diverges, and it's a finite time. But we don't have infinities in nature. And there are no infinities here. So this sum is actually always finite. But it's very, very large. So according to this principle of combination and innovation through combination, you get a vast number of possibilities that open up just like that. Maybe
is that super exponential, or do you know?
It's super exponential, yeah. Yeah, it's above exponential. I'm actually, I think I have time for the two. So I'm going to give you one example of what this describes. And there's a paper, this paper, it's actually a very good paper, but okay, they're not physicists, so they made a mistake. The innovation in human technology. So for this is actually the curve that this is they're trying to describe here. For during, you know, 100,000 years ago, the number of tools known to humans was a few, less than a dozen. Fast forward to another 1,000 or 10,000 years, still a dozen, or it increases by 24 or 30. And it continues like that. And today, so thousands of years with no significant innovation in human thought and capacity. And today, there are only 60 years between the first flight of the Wright brothers and the man landing the woman. And the, sorry. humans landing on the moon. So that's the kind of explosion that you get and is they're trying to capture. You have a completely slow period of nothing happening, and all of a sudden you get this. And sorry, what was I going to say? I completely forgot it. Okay, it doesn't matter. So, so this is the equation. We then can apply it to any number of subsystems that you choose on the biosphere, and that's the difficulty, because we don't know what is the fundamental unit, the kind of discrete scale that you can use to build up information in the biosphere. So sometimes I try to describe it as, imagine that we're taking a photograph of the entire biosphere. Somehow we're able to take a three-dimensional photograph, and then you want to compute the information in that photograph. And you could say, well, okay, I'll choose a pixel. But we don't know, there's more complexity that is described just by a pixel in a photograph. So that's the kind of problem, and that's the most challenging obstacle we have right now, is to choose the right unit to describe the evolution of life. Andrew made this brilliant discovery, which he claims that he was asleep when he did this. And he woke up in the middle of the night and he wrote this down, went back to sleep, and he doesn't know how it happened. But he discovered there's an analogy from that combinatorial type equation. It can be given by Pascal's triangle, which measures the number of combinations at each step that are possible. So if you add all the elements in one line of the Pascal triangular, you get the number of combinations. And I didn't put here, but it's actually, this is given by 2 to the n numbers, given by whatever number you're considering in your set of objects. And the point here, this is a highly simplified model of the type equation, you know, discrete time steps, step by step. But if you start with just two elements and combine them, putting alpha equals 1, let me say again, alpha here is supposed to weigh down the combinations, and you have extinction as well, which is not here, but we can put, and we have put now, the extinction rate. But you can get, I mean, vast number of states or of combinations very fast. So clearly, alpha cannot be this large, or you know, the biosphere would have exploded, or I don't know. There's no infinities, but it becomes very large at some point and very fast. And that's I guess that's the main argument. This is the kind of options that we have for choosing an ontology. I don't know if you guys, this is a philosophy argument I can talk about in terms of choosing the fundamental variable for biology. So we, for example, we can say there's 10 to the 5 variables in one organism. That's very simplistic, by the way. But there's, or you can say there's 100 billion species, and let's compute the correlations between them in the past. Or there's organisms in a species. And so with these more simplistic arguments, we already get something like this. But it's not lambda. And we really need to find a variable, which I believe, in my opinion, is going to be organic molecules. And I can explain why. So that was the talk. There's a couple of ideas that I want to pass here. So the first thing is, why is this so incredibly hard and cumbersome? And really, you know, most of my days I wish, why am I not running Cosmo MC and writing down, you know, a Lagrangian with 100 variables? But everything is easier than this. Why are we doing this? So that's I mean, it's very rewarding, but we believe that in this way we might be able to use physical principles to address the biosphere. And now this is my personal hope, or that we could get a machine to derive our this complexity in that emerges. So we all say there is no principle that you can use for deriving the new effective interaction that is about to emerge. And I thought, I was talking with, I don't know if you know Jaron Lanier, he works at Microsoft, and he told me in Lee that he has a vast, you know, black box available that we can put anything we want into it, and it's going to come back, and Microsoft is very excited, etc. So I thought, well, why don't we just feed it this data from this sequence of regimes? I mean, it's a deep learning machine, so maybe it will be able to distill some complex law. So that's kind of what one way that we could go about deriving a phenomena. So this is the main result for me. And this is what really allowed us to understand that why is the configuration space in the biosphere so large and almost infinite. If there are new bound states always emerging, you're always adding new possibilities to the configuration space. And so this possibly exceeds lambda. It most surely, but hopefully in a good way, modifies the quantification of the initial conditions. So with this quantification of diversity, you can kind of get an information theory point of view of our placement of the planet in the universe, and how much degrees of freedom we have in biology. And then, you know, I really hope that this will be one day part of cosmology, that I don't know how many millennia we have to wait, but at some point we will try to describe all phenomena. And so maybe you were starting a new field. And that's it.
Let's take the standard model and let's change a little bit the masses of up and down quarks.
Uh-huh.
Let's make sure that the proton mass is larger than the neutron mass. So in this universe, there is no biology.
Yeah.
How would you handle that?
If, well, in that universe, I wouldn't be a scientist.
Yes.
So I didn't derive any theory. So there is no... It's just died. You know, if I if you need, you need to ask, when anybody asks you, compute the entropy today, you need to ask back, what interactions are you considering? Because like we saw, you get a wrong value for thermal, for gravity, possibly for the vacuum energy. So the first question you ask is, what interactions am I taking into account in my computation of the entropy? And for your question is the same thing. Can I use the standard model to compute that?
Model.
Yeah, so that's a small, that's a much smaller configuration space. Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, I don't think it's very consistent to ask, because I derived the standard model in this universe, and then you're taking me to another one and saying, oh, now apply it here. And I feel uncomfortable, but I think it can be done. And it's smaller. The configuration space of that universe is smaller. I think Tobias was first, I'll get you.
Yeah, so usually what we mean by entropy is something like the possible number of microstates that can give rise to a given macrostate. So I'm a little worried that this very definition assumes the kind of reductionism that you're denying, namely that you can explain or that a given
possibly
has,
possibly maybe I. The value that's why I.
What you seem to be doing is to count something like the number of possible macrostates, right? So maybe this is a bit.
No, this is the microstates. Microstates in biology. Because macrostates, we don't know what is a macrostate of biology. It could be the macrostate of all living systems, states, this microstate. But anyway, that's a good point. Mutual information is. For me, the way to correctly count degrees of freedom in a way that is dependent on the context. So
that's mutual information in which to think.
Correlation, yeah. So it's mutual information. Say you have a metallic rod with a north pole and a south pole, and your states are the two possible variable values of these poles. So you'd say there's four states, either positive or negative, but the rod, the states are correlated, because you don't have two north poles, and so you'd reduce the number of states of the mutual of the set to three, and so this is two variables. Now put all the particles in the biosphere plus whatever else new. Ways of interacting that we have not yet studied, and then you will get a very correct accounting of what is diversity and how much diversity there is. If we only knew how to compute mutual information for such a large number.
So we want to consider not mutual information between two things or two variables, but
between.
Then there's many different notions of mutual information.
I think it's very well defined. I'm not going to go into that, but we can. There's a mathematical expression. It's just that we don't know enough biology to compute it.
There's different mathematical expressions already.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what was it? Sorry, I forgot. If I had anything else to say, Latham.
I guess I just wanted to say that my impression is that when you were setting things up at the beginning of the talk, that you were making an argument in words, which just doesn't hold up when you try to in equations, which is that this argument about when you go to a low energy effective field theory that it somehow adds more entropy to the system, or that it counted in addition to the the entropy that you already got from the high energy effective theory. So to take the case of QCD, like at above the QCD scale, we have a relatively small number of quarks and gluons, and then below the QCD scale, there's a lot more mesons and baryons available to work with. But if you calculate the entropy at those energies, and say temperatures or energies below the QCD scale, where you can work with that theory of low energy mesons and baryons, there's less because you ultimately you can only do the phase space integral up to the this low cutoff, the QCD scale. You can't integrate over momentum
but that's,
or above that scale.
So,
and then you don't add that entropy also to the QCD entropy. When you're counting the entropy of the low momentum modes, you have two choices. You could either count it in terms of QCD or you could count it in terms of the theory of mesons and baryons. You could do it either way, but you can't do it both ways. That would be double counting. So that's the same physical theories, and it just one is happens to be a lot easier to work with, but
yeah, if one theory doesn't include the other, I think so you're describing a system in physics for which I said there is no problem whatsoever. We've got it all under control. So the it's only for biology and possibly for condensed matter.
My worry is that I don't know of any examples where this phenomenon does happen.
Okay, then Nathan, Latham, let's have complex organic molecules and classical Newtonian equations of motion. And we write down, I don't know how many molecules are in the cell, but 10 to the 10, say. We write down 10 to the 10 equations, and now we have itemized every organic molecule in the cell. What are you going to learn from those equations of motion about the evolution of the cell? What is the cell going to do next?
I agree with you that you can't solve it in practice, but that's different than saying that there's some that they don't describe the system in principle. They don't describe the system in principle.
In principle.
There's no new degrees of freedom in principle, but it so happens that the fundamental description is too hard to work with, and in some cases you can find a simpler description involving that is possible to work with. I think that's a crucial difference here.
So you are portraying the archetypal physicist. In the sense of the resistance to abandoning reductionism is big. And ultimately, I agree with you that it's not in principle, but what I am very strongly convinced of is that we need new methods to derive these emergence of complexity. And I mean, we're not the only people thinking about this. There is this book that I just quoted, if you know what edge means, John Brockman has very smart people in the group of writers that he uses, and these questions that several physicists are asking. So it's not as if there's no agreement. There are some people that say, okay, I could derive that if I just had enough time and a large enough computer. And for me, a matter of taste, that's not acceptable. That's the same reason why I'm not a multiverse person. If your theory requires more Hubble times or more Hubble spaces to be explained, that's not going to be useful for me. So I want to contain cosmology within the one universe. That's a matter of taste. So I think ultimately there's arguments for and against. But there's definitely physicists on both sides of the wall. And I think Stu has a very sharp accounting of what exactly is going on why are there so many more complex states arising at all time? And this is the innovation in combinatorial equations. So is it okay to say that there's people on both?
There's what?
People on both sides, you know, that's not what I want. Some physicists believe what you believe, some physicists believe that it is not derivable. I believe that if it's derivable only with excess Hubble times in a complete non-ergodic universe, that's not a theory that I find acceptable.
I would agree that there may be people on both sides. It sounds like there are, but I don't think I agree that it's just a matter of taste. I think that there's.
You don't agree that it's a matter of taste today, oh, that's a matter of taste today. There's no evidence whatsoever in each direction.
So I would say that there is evidence for the fact that when you give a more coarse-grained description of a system, that you do not add new degrees of freedom to the system, or get some new.
That's true.
New
That's true.
Entropy, both from the physics examples where we do know how to actually calculate things.
Mm-hmm.
Also on general grounds having to do with the fact that if the interactions in the universe are local,
that's reasonable.
And things come from integrating, integrating out more and more on the path integral.
Okay, so let's take this offline. I will.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, Lina had a question.
Short one. So if this biological system will be eventually eaten up by a black hole, you're coming back to your...
Sorry, what is that?
So your biological system that you're considering, if it will eventually be eaten up by a black hole,
will
come back to your black hole.
And then you have a firewall
kind
of thing?
Oh, no, I'm just saying that you will then end up at the same system that you discussed in the very beginning, that you're just having your black hole entropy. And I was just wondering how you...
Oh, that's very interesting. That's very interesting.
The intermediate state could have any kind of consequence.
Oh, yeah. So there is this accounting of what happens when a black hole crosses the cosmic horizon. They how does the entropy of the universe increase? So they have discussed that. Not for biology, so that's a good point. I'm sorry, Latham, that I don't get to say more, but we'll take it offline. And I deliberately did not include that because... It's a long discussion. And the last thing that Lena just reminded me of is exoplanets. So one of the nice results is that of this kind of argument is that in one biosphere, you have as much information as in any number of biospheres that you could have. So say that we have a number like 10 to the 22, number of solar systems kind of thing. And then, you have information of the biosphere, which is kind of like this if we manage to compute it. And the biospheres are not correlated. They're all independent variables. So you just add each biosphere's entropy to the count. So actually, despite having lots of exoplanets, you're just comparing 22 with this. If there were correlations between biospheres, then you would take these up to the exponent. But if there's no correlations, you're just adding different entropies of planets. So the argument of there being more biospheres than possible planets with life doesn't really change this discussion. Okay, thank you.